came to Toronto, I guess, many months ago now, and claimed to be Bob. With some skepticism, I welcomed him into the studio, and he's...
another one, eh?
Oh, you've had more then, have you? Remember, this is a calm debate. Now, let me have my piece. This is not crossfire on CNN or any of those debate shows. Now, look, you just said Bob is everywhere. Under electronic conditions, we are everywhere. Satellites can pick us up and broadcast us everywhere. So you're not only in Dallas and here, you are wherever else your voice is being projected. And it could be myriad of places on the planet under satellite conditions. That's right, different dimensions. I've talked about this often on the show. Now, I call this state discarnate, a disembodied intelligence, all right? Now, this can only happen when you're live on the air. It only happens passively when you're not listening, when you're not using the electric media, and that includes the telephone. So you say Bob is everywhere, then anybody on the line, on the electric situation, is everywhere. In your book, The Subgenius, which is my files that you've absconded and juxtaposed in a rather collage effect.
But the true Bob requested that we rewrite his admittedly clumsy, rather awkward writings.
No, I didn't. I didn't do that. Now, the point is that what was left out of the book is all this knowledge about discarnate. Now, since we are all Bob and discarnate, the only one who would really be Bob is the one conscious of this fact. In other words, the inheritor of the knowledge of Finnegan's Wake. You have no reference to Finnegan's Wake or any of the media analysis.
And for those who have eyes to see, it's all in there. Everything is in there.
Well, that's the point. This is your visual bias. You said eyes to see, and you also talked about Bob does not use wires or lines. Electricity does not flow along wire. It is a magnet. It is an electric erogenous zone, a tactile zone we are all involved in. So that any linear images like eyes, lines, and wires are inappropriate. But this is perfectly natural to an American whose whole republic was built on visual space via the printed press and Ben Franklin. Therefore, your bias is visual, and that's why it's awful hard for you to use other media besides the book, and a bit of radio, but only on tape, I take it.
What? A bit of radio? A bit of books? My God, do you realize the word of Bob is being spread about the world by spray paint cans, probably the most effective method of communication ever?
Puny effort, puny.
Even more powerful, word of
Yes, but the electric environment supersedes and subsumes any hardware, software, gadget. Therefore, to be aware of this fact...
Well, the pinks certainly does.
No, no, no. The pinks are unconscious of it. The subgenius I am trying to make conscious, and that's why I had to come to Toronto in 1982 after Dr. Beter's situation in the Battle of the Harvest Moon and then the First Reich in September 82. As a result of winning that, and we now have the Christian faction of Russians under Gorbachev leading and taking over the planet, I had to move to Toronto, the heart of the Bolshevik controlled in the North America area, and no longer operate under Dallas, which was, as you know, controlled by the Rockefellers, who are now obsolete.
And I'm afraid I can tell by this man's outdated notions that this is yet another false Bob. For does it not say in Prescriptures 8:14, there shall come false slackmasters and non-prophets, and these shall be in the nostrils of the true Bob as the rotting of pig carcasses. Yet there shall be believers in them, for with every minute one is born. So saith the true Bob.
Now listen, Stang, Doug, the problem is that you're talking about false prophets who are angels. That's an old visual image. An angel can be anywhere, two places at once, after projection or whatever, but a super angel is everywhere at once. In other words, if you leave your body and move into astral zones, you can be still where your body was and where your zone was, but you're only in that place, in the astral zone, in the physical place. But electrically goes around all these astral and old nature terms. Bob, me, is dealing with the new nature. And to get personal, how come you're being supported by very, say, not a very profitable situation, and I am immensely wealthy, and there are people here who could testify to that. Isn't Bob very wealthy?
Yes, and where then is my money?
Well, you don't deserve it.
The thousands were died as sacrifices trying to resurrect the true Bob after the, assassination, unquote.
Yeah, you know, you set that up. Just explain my absence. Now, you work with McGraw-Hill and Simon Schuster and get the books published and a bit of media coverage, but of course no money because you were forced to work through the pink system. I have all the money. Wherever it goes, it comes with me.
Look, now, this is all a moot point to begin with. Our voice analyzers here, and make it very plain that you are not the true Bob. A true subgenius, yes. We can tell that from your vocal talents that the blood of the mighty, yes, he does course through your veins, and as such I welcome you as a brother. But as a folk, let me put one test to you.
Okay.
All right, one test. And this is something only the true Bob Fobs could know.
Oh, yeah.
How many lice can dance on the head of a pinhead, eh?
How many lice?
Uh-huh.
How many lice? One. Me, Bob, Minute Bob, Subatomic Bob, and also Super Angel Bob can dance on the head of a pin, and that's the only life that can get away with it.
My friends, those of you listening by radio, this is seditious blasphemy. Every true subgenius knows that 525,306 lice can dance on the head of a pinhead to Dr. Sabab music. But this is seditious blasphemy. This is some, yet another, probably a hireling of the Illuminati, sowing confusion and dissent. Oh, wait until the subgenius Inquisition gets a hold of you, my friend, much less Bob himself.
Ivan, it's Mike Dyer again, Ivan. I'm sorry, it's sort of gotten out of hand here. We really had no way of knowing whether this was Bob. We just had taken this man's word, and we thought we should come to the source.
I'm very glad you did. The Brotherhood of Bob
would
know where to strike next.
Well, Ivan, you mentioned that other false Bobs have shown up. Maybe you could describe their characteristics and what someone can look for when they're looking for a false Bob.
Generally, they first tell you that they're cheap. They'll break it to you slowly. And a person in a position like myself, I am not the founder of the Church of the Septenius, by the way. You committed a mortal sin by saying that. I'm merely one of Bob's more highly placed employees.
later.
Not a bad retort, but the point is, I have so much slack
the money and the associates I have around me are nowhere near what you have. And so we can rest this debate by just seeing who ends up by the year 2002, with that 22 element there. By the year 2002, we'll see who is in more subgenius black field power between us. All right? Let's just wait it out.
I agree that this argument is beginning to sound like Jimmy Swaggart and the Assemblies of God, and we should probably, despite our obvious differences, I'll take you up on that offer there, except that by 2002 I won't be on this planet. I will have been ruptured up into the vessels of the sex goddesses of Planet X on X-Day 1998.
Yeah, but you're waiting for an event that's already happened. Under electric conditions, we live 200 years every 12 months. So 1998 happened earlier this year, and that was when the exit landed and I had the election. So you're way behind even in your sense of time at this point. The dateline for dominance is obsolete.
Well, the dateline for dominance is always updated according to the sacred law of erasability.
Council of Secret Council of Ten. Boss.
Bob. Boss. Bob. I do sound like the boss?
Yes. Like
okay,
you are addressing some... Some
underling,
operation.
Some staff member.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, here's the amazing thing. That's in April 13th, 1988. 20 years later, we go to Hawaii. Stang is saying the first aberrated follower of his church was a guy who came from Hawaii, claiming he was Jesus and demanded to get on Johnny Carson that night. This Hawaii vibe is incredible. I did not know I'd be in Hawaii back in 1988, but re-listening to this, isn't that amazing, Carol?
Yeah.
That this predicting of me, this miming of me, this prefiguring of me in Hawaii. Okay, that's point number one we just discovered. Point number two is he, what was that? The money, what was it? A second synchronicity. What could have been? The materials, the... Anybody notice it? Probably not. No, okay. So what would it be?
Mike had a little synchronicity when he was talking about the little people, which is now little man.
Right. What was he saying about the little people?
Just letting them in to take calls.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So what is it that the other point, is it something about the publication of the... Oh, yes. I say that he didn't have the Finnegan's Wake archive. I took that with me from Dallas, okay? And I'm talking about the Ten Thunders and the McLuhan aspect of the Finnegan's Wake archive. I get the Finnegan's Wake archive, the extra cake, 2 years later, 1990, when Nelson gets me the five copies of McLuhan's individual copies of Finnegan's Wake with all his annotations and I Xerox that. I anticipate claiming the Finnegan's Wake archive before I actually had it, at least the important contribution of McLuhan. That is something that's incredible. You get that, Roxana? I'm claiming that he didn't have the Finnegan's Wake archive, that I got it, and then I really got it 2 years later. All right? Point number two. That's what I just discovered by an in-depth replay of that experience.
Yeah, you're in a weird loop.
Oh, you can't make out what I'm saying?
Yes, but I say you are like in
a weird
loop. Like you.
Metaphysical loop, you're right, you're right.
Yeah,
metaphysical loop. Well, we're happy to have you here, Roxana, and the treasury of your wisdom, and end off the 20th hour or something of the show. I'm not even tired, right? I'm not if I didn't want to go to the beach, it could go on for hours here, go on for another day.
It's what I'm always saying, and I was amazed, like everybody starts dropping, and you're there just talking nonstop.
That's right.
That's something you never get used to, Roxana. You never get used to that. You are always amazed at Bob's stamina.
That's true. Yeah, she can't get over that.
I mean, I have tried to do it, but there's always a point where I just faint. My bed is beside the computer, so I just faint and drop.
That's your superpower, Bob. That's what makes you a Superman. And it's so incredulous, so invisible.
Yes. What do you make of it, Carol? What do you make of how do you witness my energy in terms of staying up all night? It's not strange to you. You're used to it, right?
I'm used to it, but you've said it many times, and it's the case when you can engage and have good interaction, it feeds you.
Yeah.
So as long as people can stay up with you and give you dialogue
you are my content. I program the content and I eat you people.
Yeah.
No, but I think nobody in the world loves to communicate as much as you do. That's why you evoked Ion.
Yeah.
That's right. I was the most in love with Mortar, or at least the conversational level.
Well, would you say you were making walls all the time? Out of mortar?
Walls? No.
Well, what is mortar?
No, I'm always knocking down the walls. That's what I'm a janitor, keeping the mortar as fresh as possible. That's what I do.
So in 53, when you were assigned to Marshal McLuhan in 53, you were to check him out and maybe subdue him if he knew too much, or not subdue him? Let him thrive?
Oh, no, I was to subdue him. What happened was he wrote that essay in December 53, and he exposed the intelligence principle that the meeting was the message. That's what intelligence agencies knew, you know, since, the end of the 19th century. So they just said, who is this guy? Now, I'd screwed up in Iran, and I was being punished and banned. The Europeans thought America was a dumb place, so I was banned to America. So they said, while you're there, check out this McLuhan guy. How did he get this, you know, worked out? So I met him in the early 54 and found out that he'd been informed by Wyndham Lewis during the war, World War II, when Lewis lived in Toronto and then down St. Louis with McLuhan. And that was my first, in retrospect, Xenocrity, because I had met Lewis. Lewis was a friend of my father's. This whole Lewis thing was me, like, sent out to search something, and turns out to be my next-door neighbor kind of metaphor, right?
Let me guess, you were a teenager.
No, in 1953, I was 31, 32.
No, I mean, when you met Wyndham Lewis, you were how old?
Oh, yeah. I was just, I think that's 36, 37, so I'm 15. Yeah, I didn't know. I didn't understand who I met. He gave me a flash. All the greats gave me a psychic thing. You can look it up in my diaries, whatever one he gave me. I don't remember. And you look and see what flash I got from him. But the thing is that, so then I started sort of hanging around McLuhan and being careful and seeing what's going on here. And that's when I met Ted Carpenter. And you'll see me, I have a fight with Ted Carpenter over Ray Birdwhistle, who was the CIA guy in the anthropology world. And so there are a few diary entries that explain how I slowly befriend McLuhan, and it's not until about 10 years later that I realized that after talking to my father at the end of the 50s that the Sea Council 10 is a limited institution, and that I'm going to have to create my own scene. So that's when I took my recent acquaintances, Zappa, Garrett Dean, and McLuhan, and later LaRouche, and helped make them famous. And that's what happened. So I betrayed my employers in terms of supporting McLuhan privately. And that's the best summary of what happened. I mean, he actually, you know, I learned something from him. I learned something something about him. He contributed something. And then I thought, well, my seniors in Europe don't understand this North American pop culture world. And Lewis wrote the book in 1948, American Cosmic Man, explaining that Europeans didn't understand it. And McLuhan understood that, so...
You're a person who knows something most people don't know.
Right, and I knew stuff McLuhan didn't know, but I recognized that he knew something. I didn't know about Finnegan's Wake back then. I didn't understand it. I mean, I knew of it, but I didn't read it. And I learned from him, because I always remained a decent person, open to new things. So I learned from him, I learned from all the other holy offices, and I helped them, and they helped me. So it worked out. And there were people who resented me not offing McLuhan, or I don't know if it ever was going to get to that point, but the oligarchy had to deal with McLuhan by the late 60s. And they really,
I can't imagine the need for killing that man. A public incredulity should protect him as some kind of hedge forever.
Right, but he wasn't killed. And though some people think he was murdered in 1980, that's a whole other story there. We got information on that from GLOW.
So he was fragile enough that you could just... Fragile enough that you could add something and just tip the balance and he would die.
The Europeans were totally confused, and the oligarchy were confused. They didn't understand anything that was going on after Elvis started. They just went into retreat, and America moved forward.
So they were shocked that they were no longer in control.
Right. And they didn't want to understand how it happened. And I gradually learned how it happened. And, you know, Wyndham Lewis is the genius. His book in 1948 predicted what happened. And McLuhan writes a letter about it saying, the book is a bomb, but no response, and genius goes unrecognized.
Again. Once again.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to just, you don't talk. I want to see what Sarah thinks, what Roxy thinks, what Gene thinks, and whoever else is going to talk. What did you think of Stang? Too bad the Stang was too a little too distorted, but you got the gist of it, right? I was explaining to him, I was being McLuhan to him, I was explaining the environment that his art was going to be confused by. And I did say, we'll see what happens in 2000, by 2002, who's better off? Well, obviously I was better off in 2002 than he was, so I won that point too. Do you have nothing to say?
Well, I still, I mean, when you explain it, it's so clear how to program the environment and why.
Yeah.
The environment is the new art.
Right.
But I have the impression people are freaked out by just the idea of having such power.
Did you see that in Stang? Did you see that in Stang? Was he freaked out?
Yes, because they usually say you're a megalomaniac or a just crazy guy that is talking nonsense.
I mean,
because
I tried to
like,
explain to him. Go
it's
ahead.
Too much.
Yeah, I tried to explain to him logically.
A possibility.
Yeah, I explained to him logically why what the subgenius didn't know. And I was there generally trying to help them understand a little extra situation about the world that they've never responded to. So it was a generous act by me to even discuss it with them. But, you know,
yeah,
Stang,
Bob, I noticed that you were very calm. You know, you usually you have that intensity and you're trying to get your words in, but with Stang, you were very calm and you were just patient with him. And he wanted to bite. I couldn't hear him very well at all. I couldn't make out a lot of his words. But it was interesting to hear that because all I could hear from Stang was this, you know, blah, 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 blah. And you just maintained this very calm state, you know, and corrected him. And you mentioned the movie, the Mediacology. And I didn't hear what he said, but I could tell he said something. He barked about that, and and you clarified that. You said, no. You know, no, this is what the movie's about. So I'm thinking about what's to come.
The difference is like they're playing and just making fun.
Yeah.
Like creating this
mere
cult.
Satirist.
And then
mere
then
satirist.
You come and you do it like it's serious. It's for real. So that's, I think, for them sort of scary and shocking. Like these guys believing what he's saying for real.
He's the satirist. He's in the art quadrant, if you look on the chart, in the Kroger quadrant. I'm in the doctor scientist quadrant.
Yeah.
That's why I am. So, I was talking technically.
Yeah, and we often joked about how these primo satirists couldn't even take satire. Their satire.
Right.
Get it.
Now, what's interesting, that's April 88. Now, he kind of likes me. He does say I'm a subgenius, and he leaves it open. Okay, let's leave it at that, and we'll wait until 2002. And he's hoping he will not be there because he'll be off in the vehicles in 1998, but I said, no, it's already happened. It happened 6 weeks before, first week of March, 88. And this is 6 weeks later. The X's have shown up. That's part of the reason why we were doing it, so letting him know. Well, if 6 months later, we visit him. We go to we go to Dallas and spend a day with he and his wife and kids.
You can't get
and
ready
so everything
now.
Was okay. Everything was sort of okay. He tolerated what I was doing. He didn't have a headache until the album came out. that's when he lost his balance. That's when he decided I was possessed by a demon, Ion says.
Was it just because of the image?
Probably. Jerry Belanger. Jerry Belanger shouldn't have done that, and Nelson didn't do it. Tell him to do it. He used a Dobbs head, but he was just a kid, and he didn't know. So I understand that. So Nelson fired the kid and started advertising without that image. In fact, I should scan or show the ads. They're pretty neat, our ads, what we say in them.
If the image had never ever.
What?
If the image had never ever been there, would Stang have had any beef with you?
That's a good question. I don't know. That was his beef. What he offered, he said, he got in touch with Nelson. He said, why don't we, you give us a bit of your profit? He said, you've sort of aligned yourself through that image with us, so people are going to buy you. Give us some points. Or put a sticker on it saying you're not connected to the Church of Subgenius. And I had nothing to do with the album, but I did discuss the marketing of it because I was being interviewed a lot from that point on. And I said, no, let's not compromise at all. We want it to appear like their stuff. I want the confusion, is what I said. So Nelson didn't put the sticker on.
So it's the best kind of advertisement.
It's amazing. It's a 30-year performance.
Yeah, that's right. It's the 92.
Non-stop happening.
No, it's 20. It's 20 years. Well, I went public in the early 80s, so it's 30 years. But the album has been 22, 23 years. The war has been for 22 years. And now we're leaving messages.
So we are celebrating the 22th anniversary.
Yes,
of the
world. 22nd birthday. Yes.
The bomb.
Yes.
And throughout the whole thing, your energy. Your energy has been as if you were empowered by Coldplay.
Right, right. And the last thing I said to him, you see what happened, I've said this a few weeks ago, we visited him, his wife fell in love with Carolyn, wanted to learn about homeopathy. We arranged for her to meet a teacher in that area, in the Texas area. And a couple of weeks or months, I called Stang back and said, is everything okay? She understood. She got the name. And he said, yes. He was a bit irritated. And he was irritated about this, about us interfering in his family and she being influenced by Carolyn. This is his wife that she eventually leaves him, kicks him out, 10 years later. So at the end, as I noticed his attitude, so at the very end I said to him, I will make millions of dollars more than you'll ever make. I declared I'd be way richer than he'll ever be because he was trying to be rich. I mean, he's trying to make rich and then get slack and go on the sex vehicle. So I declared, I boasted to him that I will be way more powerful than you. It's the last thing I said to him. And that was in December 88, January 89. And then that was it.
Well, you reached that finish line long ago.
Yeah, yeah. And now we're out of sympathy. We are calling him. We did it again tonight. We called and left him some messages and had Ion talk to him. And we're trying to bring him into the fold, have him start to have have consultations with Ion on the show and, like a psychiatrist and help him out of his misery.
I love the tonality of Ion on these messages to Stang.
Yeah.
Somehow, I don't know, he becomes compassionate all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it's perfectly compassionate to talk about how the fax machine isn't faxing coffee over at all and stuff like that.
That's right. Yeah, Ion's following the agenda. We're doing outreach. We want to help him. We want to help anybody in this Church of Subgenius who's open to it to repent and acknowledge that I fulfilled their dream and they should take advantage of it.
Well, I hope at the very least he chuckled.
What did Jim say?
At the very least, I'm glad to hear that he chuckled.
Yes,
that's true.
Okay, yeah. That's what Ion said he did, so that's cool. And now, Gene.
Well, then I think that's a nice reaction. Nice reaction. Hope for Stang.
Yes, that's right. Go ahead, Gene.
this whole thing started because you had a conversation in a bar one night in Texas.
I overheard them talking in February. It was my birthday. February 2nd, 19th. So there's a prophetic point. It was my birthday in a bar in Dallas. It just as I overheard 20 years before in the spring, I think it is, of 58, I heard Beefheart and Zappa talking as 18-year-olds in a bar in the Lancaster Mojave Desert. 20 years later, 1978, I hear The Next Generation doing a multimedia version of Zappa, at least on a satirical level. And
who did you hear?
So I heard them. They were talking Illuminati stuff. Because they had just read Robert Anton Wilson and his books, and they were maybe aware of the Discordian thing, he and Philo, and they were like college kids excited about ideas about the conspiracy, which was starting to become very a big meme in college world in the late 70s, thanks to Robert Anton Wilson's popular books, the Illuminatus Trilogy, which is on my chart. And so I went over and started talking to him and sort of tried to, like, early version of Telling Sound About Ion, said, look, here's some a different way to look at what that subject. And I laid out five aspects. You can read it there. What was it? The neuron, the X-Files, the CIA, the genetic engineering, and the archetype, I think it is. And
where did you say that is?
It's on chat.
What is? Oh, you just posted it?
No,
yeah.
I'm asking you, where is that, these five aspects you talk about?
It's on chat right now, but it's in my diary, February 2nd and February 3rd, 1978, right there on the you go on the timeline, and then just go to the date and click on the word detail and you give it a diary. But here's what it says. Doug St. Clair Smith, sitting in the same bar, I guess this will be the next day. He says, can you run that by us again, Mr. Dobbs? Dobbs, I say, ontologically, each one of us is now constituted of one-fifth chip, one-fifth neuron, one-fifth astral body, one-fifth television screen, and one-fifth archetype. Epistemologically, we are now constituted of one-fifth NASA, one-fifth CIA, one-fifth X-filing, one-fifth human scale, and one-fifth genetic engineering. So I'm picking up on the five-body template, you know, in an early...
Yes.
Premature layout.
Hey,
talking about
I think
an early version.
What?
It's an early version of your model.
And ontologically, that would be your private citadel of consciousness. That's your sovereign self. The epistemologically, that's knowledge. That's social mortar. So I've got the two things: your private citadel of consciousness, your God power, and social mortar. And then Gene just posted the actual link. Can you see the? The chat line, Roxy?
No, I'm only on Skype.
Oh, okay. Anyway, just go to the timeline and go to February, or look at this later, February 2nd and 3rd. So that happened, and I didn't think anything of it until in 1982, Dr. Beter came to me, and he had a flyer from the Church of Subgenius. And he says, you can read that. Read that in the diaries. And he says, this looks like your father. And I looked at it, and after a while I figured it out. I said, oh, yeah, those kids, they must have, I showed them a picture of my father. They must have done something with it. And then that was that. It was just a flyer. And then a year later, Sue was reading People magazine and reads a review of the Book of the Subgenius, like in the fall of 83, she's so shocked. It's obvious it's me from her knowledge. So she brings me the review, and I read it. And I say, oh, that's interesting. And then she gives me the book at Christmas, and I read it in January 84. And I recognize what I call parts of my files in there. They've even got a version of the Tetrad in there. It's sort of erroneous, but it's not bad for the young kids doing it.
Well, didn't they just get your name? I thought they just got your name in the late 70s.
No, they met me. What? I told them about my father, and I told them about his birthday, July 5th, 1976, that he had died, you know, in July 5th, 76. So when I saw the date, when Beter's flyer, July 5th, 1998, the Exus will arrive. I immediately said, well, that's my father's death date. And then I thought, oh, yeah, 76, that's 22 years. And then I remembered I told them about the 22. So they cobbled together stuff that I was saying, thinking about me, but they couldn't use a picture of me, so they took the picture of my father, what they remembered it, and found a likeness. And so you could go to dobsound.com and see the picture of my father flashing back and forth with Stang, and you'll be spooked at how similar they are.
I do. I can't see any difference at all.
Right. It
well,
is
and
a
look
photograph.
At the, look, at the look at the symmetry of that, Bob. I mean, that was two nights, that was two conversations in a bar over the course of two nights, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And they extrapolated all that and created all that out of two conversations with you.
Right.